Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by a new co-host, Sean, aka The Book Watcher. It's our first podcast together, which is super exciting. Hey, Sean, how are you going?
Hey, Roman, doing pretty well. Excited to be here.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Great to have you along. This should be a good one. We've got a cracking guest on for today's show, someone whose work I admire a lot and whose watch I actually have on my wrist right now for our upcoming wrist check, if we ever get to it. Please welcome Lewis from Ann Ordain.
Hello. Nice to be here. Hi, guys.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Hey, Lewis, thank you for making time for us. I know you're a busy man and with a young family and everything, so it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, it's good chatting with you guys.
Now, Ann Ordain, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it in a sec, but, you know, there's a little sort of, I'm not sure if you're aware, but there is a little Ann Ordain Appreciation Society here in Melbourne, certainly.
I do, yeah. It's nice.
And your company has come up on the show before as an example of kind of a young, exciting watch company doing things with integrity and spirit and also a sense of fun, which is lovely.
Yeah. It is very nice. It's always nice to hear these things. I think we're just a little bit different, and that's why maybe kind of get mentioned now and again.
Yeah, so well, you guys are punching up way above your weight, which is wonderful. Well, look, before we kind of run into that, for the three people who don't know who Ann Ordain is, you know, for new listeners, maybe give us a little bit of an intro about yourself and sort of the company.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, Ann Ordain, we're based in Glasgow. There are now 12 of us, and we are kind of it's a mixture of different of kind of disciplines of designing and making, essentially. And the idea has always been that you put the people making things and the people designing things in the same place, and what comes out is going to be interesting. So that's the simple kind of overview of what we do. The main technique we use for making the watch is enameling for the dials. And we've got three enamelers and two watchmakers now. And that's we make watches. I think that's generally the overview.
Yeah, but I think, Lewis, it kind of feels like you're making more than a watch. I mean, I've tracked your company with great interest over the last couple of years, and I've sort of, you know, been stalking, watching the site, seeing the stuff you guys are producing, but it feels more like an experience. It's really special to me. I mean, why enameling to begin with? I mean, that's generally people sometimes obsess about movements or obsess about certain particulars, but
it's a good question, because it seems so long ago that we started to become obsessed with it that I can't remember exactly why it was, but I think the idea has always been that we wanted to create something which was different. I think when you see a lot of new watch companies come out, and the designs are obviously influenced by other things, and so other watches rather. And initially we'd come up with the idea of, because there wasn't, you know, there isn't really a watchmaking industry in the UK, so we thought if you got someone to make the hands who made something similar to hands, but wasn't, you know, a watchmaker, and you got someone to make the dial who did something similar, then you would, in the end, you'd get a watch together which had all the pieces made perfectly well, but not by people who normally made them. So they'd all be made in a different way, and you'd have a watch which would be, you know, a watch, but it wouldn't look like anything else. And so that was the kind of rough idea to start with. And that's, you know, is a very kind of naive approach with when you start understanding tolerances required and things like that. But what for the dials, when I started looking for someone to be able to build a dial, we looked at coin minting. So that seemed like the obvious kind of area where there was crossover. And I remember seeing there's an Omega watch with which looks like it's got a coin for a dial, and I think that's probably where I got the idea from. But so I went down to Birmingham and visited some of the mints there, and one of the coins they had was a commemorative thing, and it had this enamel poppy on it, and I just remember thinking that's beautiful. It's this red, the red color had such sort of richness and depth. And then after that, I just realized that's what I wanted to focus on. And And it turns out that was actually not even real enamel on that on that coin. So, but it got me down on the right track. And actually, you know, after that, I spent a year, or maybe a bit longer than that, working with a with one of the mints in Birmingham to try and make a dial. But the thing is, I mean, I've still got it. It's it took about a year, and it's enormously thick and completely warped. And I think when we got that back and showed it to some kind of people who knew about watch assembly, we just realized there's absolutely no way this was going to work. So that's when I kind of approached the art school and asked if there were any kind of enamelers around who wanted to kind of work on this project. And that's when we set up the studio, was just with one kind of graduate who'd got an interest in enameling. And we just sort of sat down and started working on how we could make a dial. And I think because there are so many difficulties with producing dials in enamel that it just completely absorbs you, and you don't. That's all we. I mean, the design is a big part of what we do, but it's the enameling that we're constantly problems, especially if you're trying to do new things. That's like the watch I sent you earlier. That sampler bay technique has been causing us headaches for a year. But it's you always feel like you're about to kind of overcome the next issue. But it's a wonderful area to work in because it constantly keeps you engaged and the results are beautiful. So that's really why I think enamel appeals so much.
It's interesting how you had that, I guess, idea initially, and you engaged with mint and you went on to find other people who shared that interest at the arts college, like you mentioned. But while we're on that, I think it's quite interesting to progress down that track. But I think, Roman, unless I missed anything, are we missing the traditional start to the podcast, as in?
Yeah, it's always a bad sign when the first-time co-host and the guest know more about the structure than I do. It's always never a good sign, is it? Yeah, I think, Sean, you're right. I mean, yes, we do usually do a drink check and a wrist check, but, you know, you guys were talking, you know, I was petting the dog. You know, we seemed busy for a drink check. But anyway, let's do it right now. All right, Sean, why don't you go first?
Thanks, Roman. I am wearing a vintage Cartier Santos Dumont Ultra Thin.
Nice.
It's a watch I acquired recently, and it hasn't left my wrist at all. I've been quite in love with this piece, and as a toast to our guest, I don't know if I'm going to commit a faux pas, but I went out and I bought some Belhaven Scottish Ale.
Oh, nice!
Just to give it a try.
Yeah,
hopefully it's not, you know, to Scotland what Foster's is to Australia, but I figured I'd just give that.
No, it's a good standard beer in the pub, especially in Edinburgh. I think that's what you'd get. But yeah, no, that's impressed. Yeah.
What about you, Lewis?
Well, it's not quite lunchtime, so I have coffee and some black coffee, and I'm wearing it's a prototype one of the watches we were playing around with over lockdown that doesn't have an enamel dial, and it's something we've been looking at over the past few months, but haven't really done anything with. So it's interesting, but it's also a bit weird because it's not enamel; it just doesn't seem like one of our watches. So I think we've been kind of struggling with that. But I've been wearing one, so I'm not working.
Yeah.
I kind of try and keep it to one watch, you know, so I'm not consuming too much of our stuff.
I'm always hugely covetous of prototypes, you know, like whenever I talk to a watchmaker or, you know, somebody's, and they're like, oh, I've just got this prototype on my wrist. And like, for me, as somebody who's a pure enthusiast, you can't make anything, I can barely make a cup of tea, let alone anything more. You know, to me, that's like, wow, you've made a thing that you can wear that actually works, you know, and I want it. No, that's very, very cool. Well, I guess I better do mine as well so we can move on. So I've got, not a coincidence, I've got one of my favorite watches that I own, which is an Anordain Aussie Gold enamel that Lewis was kind enough to make for me. And I apologize both in advance and in reverse for the trouble it caused you to do a Ramoff dial.
It's actually called a Roman yellow. That's what.
That's right.
I think there's two people who have got it subsequently and on their warranty book. It's the Roman yellow.
That's right. Cool.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So, and you know, and if you are listening to this and you've got the Roman yellow dial, just get in touch with me. I'd love to connect the two watches that exist. That's awesome. Yeah. And to match my Aussie gold dial, I actually have something that I've never mixed before. I've got an iron brew and vodka mixed together, which is, I don't know if it's a thing done in Scotland. I don't think it'll be a thing done in Melbourne beyond this podcast, but it's barely possible.
It shouldn't be. And for it is done. It is done a lot.
Okay, right.
But it's not. It's not something I personally. Not a personal favorite of mine, but very common. Yeah.
No, it wouldn't be. I mean, I'm not much of a whiskey drinker. That's why I said, you know, I had to move. I couldn't do that. So I'm like, oh, I can't do a gin and tonic like I usually do. So that's my – I made an effort. That's all I can say.
Impressive. Yeah, very, very impressive. But, yeah, don't anyone else try that at home.
That's right. But I do like to color match my drinks to my watches. That's a first as well. So that's good. Well, look, Lewis, let me just take you a step back, you know, because we'll talk about enamel and the watches that you do and the design, which is very distinctive, very unique, and definitely when you talk about. I kind of want to take a step back and kind of go watches, sort of, you know, when I think of Glasgow, you know, like, you know, if you think of England,
yeah,
like Clark and Well, you know, John Harrison. Like, there's a whole industry of, or at least, you know, used to be a whole industry of watchmaking. Is there a history of watchmaking in Scotland? Is that a thing that existed? Or
I don't think. I mean, there are people who know a lot more about this than I do, but I don't think there is any more than, you know, during the periods of time where there were watchmakers in every town. No, I don't think there are any you know, big ones. But I mean, having said that, in terms of industry in the UK, the last watches which were actually made here were, you know, at the Timex factory in Dundee in the 1970s. So they closed. I think they closed in the 70s. But yeah, they had a factory here.
Okay.
And that was the last time that anyone made watches in Britain before there's people started making them again recently in varying degrees.
Sure. So how did you go from, hey, I want to do something like, you know, to a watch? Like, why watches and not enamel jewelry or brooches or something like that? You know, because I get enamel is a thing. Why watches?
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's a good question. I mean, it actually, I'd arrived at it before I was interested in watches years ago when I was just left school, and I was up in the Highlands and was thinking about how you could live here and kind of support yourself with a job. And, you know, the Highlands are fairly remote. You know, they're 4, 5, 6, 7 hours drive, depending on where you go from Edinburgh, Glasgow. And, you know, they're beautiful, but unless you want to run a B&B or become a fisherman, there's not a lot you can do up there to make a living. And so I was like, well, this somehow I decided watches would be a good thing that you could do. And it, actually, it kind of, from talking to people in the Jura Valley in Switzerland, that's sort of the same reason that it became that it works over there, is because you've got long dark winter days and not much else to do, so people can sit at home and fiddle with watches. But I didn't know that at the time, and it was kind of just this idea I'd had, and it was in the back of my mind for years, really, and I was just thinking, this is what I'm going to do in the end. And then there came a point, probably 7 or 8 years ago now, that I thought, right, let's actually start seeing if I can make this happen. And then at that point, I started getting into watches, but it wasn't. It was more of a means to an end initially, as an idea, which is just probably a weird way of getting into it, I suppose. But
probably the best way, really. Like, serendipitous is as good a way as any, I guess. What I really liked, I think, and I read that slogan on your sort of in the literature that came with my watch, you know, was the thing that said, like, in an industry obsessed with the past, it is the future that excites us, which is, you know, like, it's a lovely ethos statement. I don't know if that's the right phrase, you know, like, it's a really nice way to think.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's kind of I think we're in a bit of a bubble, really, and I like that, because, you know, it's not one of those companies where the founder, like me as the founder, would you know, says we're going to design this and kind of controls everything. It's we kind of have this just team of very talented people who are not necessarily, I think, really interested in watches, other than, you know, within what we do. I mean, there's a couple of the people who I, you know, can see us starting to get the watch bug and are coming up with really kind of obscure references for watches. That's something.
There's weird people in every company.
There are, but generally it's not. So I think when you do that, you're kind of, you know, like Imogen's a typographer, and she's her sort of obsession is typography and design. So the her creations on when we've got new fonts or dials are coming from the world of typography rather than coming from the world of watches, which and you know, similarly with the enamelers, they're you know, very passionate about kind of jewelry making and silversmithing and things like that. So their influences aren't necessarily from reading Hodinkee or whatever. So it's I think that kind of way of creating new designs, new products is kind of avoids them being too similar to other things.
So would you say that's design that brings you and your team together? Because you mentioned that it's always been your mind, whether to, you know, do an Airbnb, to fish, or to pursue watchmaking. But at the same time, you said it seemed like from what you mentioned earlier, that it was this specific Omega or the work with the Mint, or seeing that special edition Mint coin that really drove you to pursue enameling and to go down this path.
Yeah, well, I think they were definitely kind of stepping stones to kind of seeded ideas. But it was, I think the thing with enamel. But yeah, I definitely say design ties this all together. But enamel, I mean, obviously has been used in watches for an awfully long time. But I think my knowledge of enamel in watches at the time of kind of getting into it was just a very traditional kind of conservative designs. And when you see how enamel is used in other areas, you just the colors, I mean, the depth of color and the kind of rendering of it, it's so special that you kind of think if you could tie that in with, you know, maybe more modern designs or designs that, you know, I was more keen on, then you could come up with something really special. And it just struck me that hadn't really been done. It's very traditional enameling, which is beautiful. But doing something with more kind of a modern design that hadn't been done. And then all the, not all the team, but most of them are kind of from either Edinburgh or Glasgow, the art schools. So they have a similar aesthetic in terms of their own personal tastes. So I think that kind of gels everyone. So we're not, you know, when we're working towards something that's everyone kind of likes the same thing, I suppose. And where that the product that comes out of that is the watch. But you know, someone, you know, might have a certain taste in their field, and you know, whether that be kind of photography or typography or kind of silversmithing, and all that crossover kind of works fairly harmoniously because they're inputting to a product that's you know, the end product. And if they've all got similar tastes, then it kind of aren't too many kind of disagreements there.
Well, let's have a bit of a sort of chat about sort of the models and the evolution of the design, because even though you're a young company, 2018, I want to say, when did Model 1 come out?
Yeah, it was late, so September 2018, I think we put it up, we launched that. We started working on it in sort of a few years before that, but it was, we first went on sale in September 2018.
And so that was, I think, a run of 300 pieces, wasn't it, for your Model 1?
It was 300 pieces officially, but we had damaged or lost, or it was actually more like 260.
So even more special. So to those lucky owners of Model 1s, you're even more special than you thought you were.
That's true. That is the case, yeah.
So that's brilliant. I mean, and that was what you were saying before about using enamel in a really unique for watchmaking way. That's very true, because I mean, one of the things that attracted me to your company when I bought my watch, which would have been
early on in 2018, or soon after release, I think, because I was must have been early enough that you were still kind enough to do a custom order for me, was actually the colors that I hadn't really seen in enamel, you know, because I love an enamel dial in a traditional Swiss watch, and it's either very white, very beautiful, but, you know, really white, or it's kind of pearly, you know, pearly white. So it's like, you know, either shiny white, pearly white, or black. Like I haven't seen, you know, the colors you come out with were just beautiful visually as well.
Yeah, there's, I mean, blue is another one which you get. I think that's another very classic color. It was just, I mean, we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of different enamels now. And when we were looking at what to launch with, it just seemed a bit silly to use black and white and blue. So, because you had all these other choices, and that, you know, we sat down as a team and kind of whittled down the different swatches of little enamel chips we'd made up and worked out what we liked, and yeah, the kind of end range was fairly colorful.
When you say you worked out what you guys liked, it's like we said, what had came before was predominantly the standard colors of, you know, black, whites, and blues, and you really exploded with the colors when it came to your watches. Was when it came to the decision for that, especially when you released the Model 1, did you have any kind of ideas or concerns about how it would be received by perhaps the community, if they'd be popular, if certain people would like them, or if you were taking a risk perhaps?
It's a funny one, because at the time I couldn't have told you if anyone was going to have any interest or buy anything. Or, I mean, we were not, we hadn't really had any contact with journalists or anything like that, or anyone in the watch community. So it wasn't, I didn't worry about people liking them or not liking them, I think. And the other thing is, I mean, obviously one of the first Model 1s we did was a pink Model 1. And it's very easy to launch a pink watch when you only make one of them. But if we'd been kind of working with a, you know, manufacturing partner, I probably wouldn't have been brave enough to make 200 or 300 of them, because we'd still have them now. But it's a lovely way of working, because you pick a color and you say that's going to be on the startup line. But no, I think in terms of the reception, I don't think I was worried, but I was, because probably I was more worried about the fact that no one might buy anything, and we spent the past 3 years working on this, that was how we started, I think.
So how do you think the word then spread? Because, I mean, I haven't seen, I mean, you're in Glasgow, we're in Melbourne, which is just about as far away from Glasgow as you can get. How do you think, I mean, the word about you spread by word of mouth more than by any other, well, at least I wasn't aware of any other advertising media or anything like that. It was purely, hey, this is such an exciting thing. It was like, I remember distinct ripple that went through, which was a beautiful thing.
That's really nice to hear. I mean, I think that was, I would like to say deliberate, but it wasn't. I mean, in the beginning, we had, I mean, making the watches in the first couple of months, we got them featured in the SJX website, which is it's a fantastic website, especially for when you want to the details there. And I think after we'd had that, everyone else kind of jumped on and kind of was, it was okay to talk about us then. And we'd got in touch with people for launch, but a lot of people were like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to be the first one to say this is good. And then as soon as SJX published it, everyone was like, this is good. But that triggered kind of a flurry of orders. And we got to this point where we kind of, initially it took so long to make the watches. Like the first 6 months, it was an incredibly stressful time, because we had a lot of orders. And you know, there would be weeks when we couldn't make a single watch. And I think we're averaging something like 2 or 3 watches a week in the early days. But it was incredibly stressful, I think, because you had customers and you just really wanted them to be kind of happy with the process and with the end product. But the difficulty of making the watches and all the just the team was less experienced then. You know, even though we'd had a good few years working up this, but I think those first few months were real baptism of fire, and it kind of taught everyone an awful lot. So by, you know, early 2019, we're in a much better place in terms of kind of being able to to get stuff out. But there was no advertising because of that. I mean, and there still isn't, actually, because we've constantly got an order list. We've always, you know, there are always orders to be made, and we're never kind of waiting around for a new order to come in. So we haven't advertised, and we haven't actually. I mean, we have this strange situation where if you launch something, we kind of send a newsletter out, and that will cause us a kind of a spike in orders. And if we were to do that and have a press release at the same time, then it would just mean that we would kind of be two or three months behind on orders, which would be which would be very unappealing for people. So it is a funny one, because when you go and talk to journalists and you tell them about the product after you've launched it, which is never very appealing from their point of view.
Someone who actually ordered my watch now that I realized during the stressful time that you were having, once again, I really apologize for making mine extra difficult. What I want to say, and I think I remarked on it because I wrote a little review for our friends at Scottish Watches about next week, and I wrote maybe a year ago now or something, and I wrote that the wait was actually – the way you handled the "this is going to take a while" was really the perfect example of how any company should do, you know, customer service for a waiting product. It was wonderful. Yeah. It was like I knew you were busy on it because I'd get an update, or you'd send me a photo going, "Hey, here is, you know, Erlen working on something. You know, yes, we've had a few test fires. It's not quite right, but yeah, we're still working on it." So I never felt like you know I'm the 150th on the bottom of the queue. Like, it was actually really nice to, like, I felt included, even though my contribution was negligible, but I never felt lost in it. And I think that reinforced to me kind of the beauty of why I am passionately in love with independent watchmakers, right? Or just independent makers of anything, because I didn't feel like a number in the queue. I felt like a customer in the kind of, in the positive, you know, sense of that word, somebody's whose custom you appreciate it. So it was really lovely.
It's nice to hear that, because I think that's what the stress was about, really, is that you have such, like, you're so grateful to people for being customers and allowing you to do what you're doing, that you really you want to keep them happy. It's not, you know, so they buy another watch, it's just because they've made that investment in you, and you just, yeah, it does get a little bit stressful. If you're kind of saying it'll be this time and then it's taking longer, but I'm happy to hear that it wasn't a miserable experience being on the waiting end of.
It definitely wasn't that.
Lewis, you don't have to hold back at this time now that, you know, Roman's already written the review. He's received the watch. You can unload on him for that stressful period. I mean, how many dials did it take to get that color?
I thought when Roman got in touch and he's like, "I want this," and I was like, I thought that's going to look dreadful, but then we made it. And I think you said, like, an orange dial, black hands with blue loom. And I was just, but no, I was convinced it's going to look dreadful. And
well, you sent me a little swatch.
Yeah. The colors we had. On paper, it sounds awful, doesn't it? There's one magazine that's got your watch as the watch that we make. It's like,
yeah, right. Oh, I haven't seen that. I better check that out. I'll get some royalties.
You should. So, you know, it ended up coming out pretty nicely, but I was completely wrong on my initial thoughts on it. But it is because black, blue and orange really shouldn't work that well, should they?
Well, I mean, I don't know. In many ways, I'd like to think it was your dial that inspired the new Rolex OP, you know, that kind of daffodil color. But, you know, allegedly, we better put allegedly in, just, you know.
Insider info.
Yeah. But it's certainly more, yeah. No, it's certainly more popular, I think, with doing bright colors now. But, that was, in terms of making that, I mean, it was, the thing with doing any custom work in enamel is that you have, because every color of enamel is made up, it's got a different composition of different parts of kind of glass or pigment, and so the the firing times and the firing temperatures are all slightly different. So it takes a lot of trial and error to get it right, which is why it can take a bit longer. But it wasn't too bad. I think yours was about 2 weeks, wasn't it, before, of actually someone, one of the enamelers working on it.
Yeah, something like that. But is it like I would have happily waited. I knew you were busy. I was just appreciative that you would do it for me as a custom thing anyway. Mm. So I was like, yeah, great. And then is it, I kept getting updates and things. I'm like, wonderful. Like it was a really warm, like I felt like it was kind of a really cordial, wonderful relationship that I knew was coming. It was just building excitement, if anything. I thought you added an extra week just to build the momentum. You know?
No, I was excited. I'm always, I mean, I you know, say yes to these things because I'm excited about them too, actually, to see how it comes out. But I think these, I should probably point out that now, because obviously that was, it did take an enameler 2 weeks to make that. We've kind of had to stop doing it because, you know, if it's the same price as a normal model one, and someone's working on it for an extra, a normal model one takes about 3 days of work, including the kind of regulating assembly and all that stuff. But if you're spending 2 weeks, it's not quite as clever an idea in terms of finances. So we will offer it now, but we kind of have to charge a bit extra.
Yeah, of course.
So just in case people listen and think that might be a plan. But then one thing we do is we mix up if there's old colors that people have used, like the, you know, from a Model 2 and they want it on a Model 1, we can do that, no problem. It's something we're familiar with. Or you actually get, you get some people sometimes asking for your watch, but they're not saying specifically, I want this watch, this guy's watch. They kind of just suggest, you don't do any yellowy orange colors, do you, or any kind of black colors? Like, well, you know where this is going. Yeah, they just don't want to ask specifically for someone else's watch.
Just direct them to me. I'll flip mine for five times the rest, and I'll get four more from you. Like, so it's easy. Like, we can we'll talk off air. We'll work that, something. Okay, out. No problem.
That's good.
The Roman yellow special.
Yeah. From Roman as well. That would be, you could sign the back.
It's kind of special, also that you know, Roman's watch was created during that period that you guys were really, you know, bustling and exploding from that story. And part of that too is you mentioned that, you know, it's been something that's kind of been years in the making, but you released the Model 1 in late 2018, September, and then next year you followed with the Model 2. I mean, what's that experience been like? Because it seems like there's been so much going on for Anne Ardain during what is relatively a short period. Mm. I mean, even now with what you mentioned about changing spaces and you know, working on future models and whatnot, what's that like, you know, this trajectory in such a short period?
Yeah, it's the Model 2 is funny because I remember the model 1's obviously very classic and it's kind of a, I suppose it's a dress watch. And with the Model 2, I remember wanting to do something that almost people didn't like. I wanted to do something that wasn't as kind of easily received. No, maybe not well received in the long term, but easily received. And so like making it a size that I thought was good, but maybe other people didn't necessarily like, and almost being a bit contrarian about it in terms of,
you know, and I applaud you on the size.
Yeah, no, we're now doing a larger version because it does, you know, it does work very well. But so in terms of it's always, I mean, there's always stuff going on. I mean, at the moment, this year's been really frustrating because it feels like we've just been put on pause since February, and there's so much stuff coming out that should be coming out that it's just been kind of really slowed down by you know, by not being able to work as we normally do. You know, the studios, we've had to space everything out, so you know, there was one enameler in each of the three rooms, whereas there would normally be kind of you know, 10 or 12 people in those three rooms. So everything's just, it's a bit slower and a bit less joined up, and we've, you know, we should have had three or four launches this year by now, but you know, obviously, I mean, there was that's why it's strange that when you look at what we've done, there's kind of two watches, but actually there's a load of stuff that's somewhere in the pipeline. So there's a lot happening, and obviously the Model 3 is quite interesting because it's a watch where that really is a special watch because it's a technique that's so difficult to kind of master. We've been working on that for about a year, just under a year, And I think we got to the point a couple of weeks ago where we had to sort of decide to stop and kind of revisit the idea in a different way. So the video I sent you earlier, Roman, is that's kind of one of the prototypes, but it's just it's not kind of a feasible thing to make. So that's another kind of slightly disappointing thing that's come out this year, is not being able to launch that.
Lewis, do you want to maybe tell us about, kind of give us a 30 seconds tutorial on enameling, just or at least the different things that you think you'd want to explore in the art of enameling, kind of thing, so the people know the differences?
Yeah, absolutely. So enameling, just as an idiot's guide, I suppose, is glass powder fused to metal. So you get a metal disc. It could be copper, silver, gold, or steel, some types of steel, and you put some enamel powder on top of it. You put it in a kiln at about 800 degrees centigrade, and you leave it in there till it melts, pull it out, and there's kind of the glass, or the powder is turned into glass, essentially, on top of the metal. And that's an enamel dial in a very simple and very rough way. The way to do what you need to do to make one for a watch is that you would have about six or seven layers of enamel on the top and some enamel on the bottom of the metal as well to stop it from warping too much. And the challenge, because jewelry enamel is fairly, there's amazing jewelry enamel actually out there. And they work with different kind of boundaries, I suppose, so that they have a lot more depth to work with, and that helps an awful lot. The challenge with watch dials is that you're talking about a thickness that is around a millimeter, you know, maybe kind of 0.95, and or maybe ever so slightly over, but it has to be perfectly uniform. And if you're talking, it's seven or eight layers of enamel with a layer of metal that is perfectly flat, and all of that fits into a millimeter in thickness. So, and you're putting that in and out of a kiln that's going from 800 degrees to 20 degrees in a, you know, studio outside the kiln. So there's an awful lot of warping and expansion and cracking, and those are things you've got to control. That's why it's difficult to do, basically, is because you really have to be on top of every aspect to make it a disc that's flawless and and kind of uniform in finish.
So what's the difference between the Grand View enamel that you were talking about and then what you were attempting to do for the Model 3 that proved to be a whole extra level?
So about a year ago, I had my anniversary with my wife. I hadn't got a print. I'll say that, but it was like 2 days before, and I'd forgotten to get her anything. And it was 10 years since we met.
You get credit for remembering the month after 10 years.
I thought I'd make her a watch because she didn't. I hadn't, you know, she hadn't got one. So so we took a silver dial and etched out little indexes and all the hours apart from 10, and it was a 10-year thing. Put a number 10 there. It was just because we didn't. If I'd thought about it a week before, I'd have got a printing plate made up and printed this, but we didn't have the time to do that. So we etched away all the silver and then filled everything in apart from these indexes with enamel.
Yep.
And that technique is what is known as champrevé.
Right.
I didn't know it was champrevé at the time. The enamelers did. But I was like, let's find it this way, and it looks spectacular because it's simple.
It really does.
Like it catches the light when it moves, but it doesn't look kind of shiny or blingy or anything when you look at it normally. And then I thought, this is so simple but so kind of effective that we could do a dial that's just got 12 numbers and no markers or no words or nothing, just kind of 12 simple numbers. But they have such kind of power of visually, there's such kind of depth and richness to this that you can get away with having 12 numbers and nothing else. It will look just enough. There's, you know, anything else would be complicating it. So then we sort of started working on this. And the issue that we've had is that if you imagine like a number 8 or, you know, or a 10 or a 6 or a 9, any of these things where you've got a closed area within the know, in number 8, you've got two circles.
Oh, of course, yes.
In the middle, yeah. So you've got these tiny pools of enamel, and when you put these into the kiln, the silver expands and the enamel expands, but the silver expands at different rates and the silver expands at different ratios, and it will squeeze the enamel, which is essentially glass, and you'll have cracks. So this is why this technique is so difficult, is that you have infinitely more challenge with cracking and expansion than you would with a standard dial. Because standard dial, you've got a layer of flat enamel and you've got a layer of metal underneath, and they both expand at different rates. And you know, with a little bit of kind of skill and practice, you can master that. But when you've got the same sort of horizontal layers of enamel and metal, but you've also got vertical metal coming up to the top and little isolated pools of enamel, and everything's expanded and contracting, it's just a very, very challenging thing to do. So we've got some prototypes out of it after a year, but it just, as a production thing, we would be spending our entire lives making these watches.
That would be stuff of nightmares. So,
yeah, it's a real shame, because I mean, I see something that's just really beautiful, and I just wanted to put it out there to show people. So I think what we might do is just launch them, but without launching them. So it's kind of just to talk about them, to help explain, you know, what we've been up to. But unfortunately, without a watch, you can kind of wear at the end of it. But we're still hopeful. I mean, we're going back to the drawing board, and we're kind of going to make the watch a little bit thicker and see if by giving it kind of maybe more metal in the base, that we could we can manage it. Lange have done, they did a limited edition for an anniversary a few years ago, which uses Champlevin. It's a beautiful dial. And they made, I think they made 10 or maybe 50, or it's a fairly small number of these dials. So it is it's doable. But I think that may be why they did it as a limited edition, just because it's such a headache.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I said I can't remember the last Champlevin enamel dial that I've seen. You know, you hear, you know, there's a few closing A1s, you see the odd one, you know, with the metal inlaid where you create the little cells and then you fill them in with enamel out of metal. I've seen a few of those, but Champlevin, I can't remember.
No, the closing A, I think, is a lot easier, because those metal, like the metal partitions essentially are just very thin wires, so they will expand almost with the glass.
Of course. Yeah.
But so it's just different challenge. But I mean, it's not going to be impossible in the long term. It's just, I think you have to, it's just something that we were hoping, because you always have issues with enameling. There's always a problem.
But that's why I think what you guys do is so amazing. And it's so handmade for the prices that you charge. I mean, it's incredible that, you know, that I know that, you know, there's five of us in Melbourne who have
anodinous,
and I know that every single one of them was a human pair of hands that took that blank, you know, that dial from a copper disc all the way to the kiln and back, and five free firings to get it. And I know it was just, you know, a pair of hands that did it, and I could call you and know who made it. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's written in the book, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's a lovely connection between, especially when you go into the workshop and you know see everyone's just focused on building their one, you know, their one dial, and you know from when the order comes in, because it's, you know, an order board of everyone's names and what they've ordered, and so each enamel knows who they're making it for as well, which the other way as well. It's not just the customer knows who.
That's lovely.
Yeah, Lewis, because it's quite an experience, if you think about, you know, the team that's making it, the watch that you're producing, and the experience you build around it, and the customers who get to share in this experience, especially in Roman's case, where he got a one-off or a 1F2 made by you guys. And you speak about the beauty of it. So I guess the curiosity for me is, you know, for Anodyne, is the focus of Anodyne, is it about the beauty, about, you know, creating this experience for perhaps the customer to have to be a part of this, or are you pursuing like a balance between, you know, watchmaking or evolution, that's going to a focus that you have that you're aiming for at a later stage? What's sort of the focus you have for Anodyne?
That's a difficult question. I think there's so many different things, but it does. There are definitely kind of long-term overall directions. And I think in terms of what we're looking at, production is certainly, it's always trying to do something new or something that we haven't been able to do in the past. So that's everything, you know, every watch is, it's a progression, or there's something new and a bit more difficult about it generally. So that's very much what pushes us, I think, for one aspect. But also, I think, like we've got over the summer, we agreed with a quite a well-known movement designer to start work on a project to build a movement. And it's so Anomaly is one, you know, is what we do, but it's mainly at the moment, I suppose, it's the kind of the bit that you see. Whereas I think what pushes us is the challenge of doing something that we haven't been able to do before, or trying new things. And I think if we were replicating aesthetics or kind of techniques that were commonly found out there, then there wouldn't be much kind of interest in it for us. So I think the feeling that we're trying to do something new, even if it's just new to the team, and mastering something that we weren't able to do, I think that's a really big appeal. So that drives us a lot. But it's not just, I mean, the enameling's where you see that. But we also, you know, one of the team is an engineer, so he does all the case design and prototyping, and we've started looking into CNC machining things with a view to kind of to getting more into the movements. And so recently we've kind of begun discussions with a movement designer who's done some really phenomenal work, and the plan is to start working with him late next year when he becomes kind of free on building our own movement. And that's a really interesting thing, because it's not, you know, I think a lot of companies would kind of want to get more expensive. They want to go up market and they see a movement as a way of doing that. Whereas for us, value is an enormously important thing. And so I think Nomos is a brand that I'm very fond of. And their attitude and their approach to movements and to the whole business has been very kind of inspirational to me. So when we're looking at the movement, it was triggered by having a really difficult time sourcing in Switzerland and just dealing with people that were not particularly...
You can be honest.
I think they were particularly interested in what they were doing.
You surprise us.
Yeah, and I mean, it was... it's been, yeah, I mean, this time last year, we had a nightmare with... Our lead times on movements were about 3 months, and then one day we put an order, and they said we'll ship them in. It was like 18 months or something, and I'm like, well, how are we going to make watches if we have any movement? So, and it's just this the attitude that they had was just, it was pretty rotten, and so it started us thinking about, and it always seemed like a bit that was missing from what we're doing is having the movement aspect, because we have, you know, we have watchmakers in house, and their job at the moment is they strip the movements down to start with, and they rebuild them to check they're good. Because unfortunately, some of the QC from some of the movement manufacturers isn't great, so we do that and we assemble them. But you know, it's not the most exciting job for a watchmaker. So I think bringing in kind of movement design and manufacturing would add some of what the enamelers have to the watchmaking kind of department. So that's something that's going to be happening in the future, but it's not going to be, you know, one of, you know, when you I see kind of in-house movements and off-the-shelf movements, not, you know, in-house isn't better than off-the-shelf. There are things like reliability, value for money, serviceability, which are enormous pluses when it comes to buying an S or something.
Yeah, absolutely,
like that.
Agree.
So I think when we build a movement, I don't want to leave all this behind and just jack up the prices and give you a watch that's harder to service, because that's not, you know, I don't think it's any of us would be happy about that. So the project that we're going to be working on is going to try and get the best of both worlds if we can. But that's and so that's another area that I think we'll come into what we do. But we're also taking. I mean, we started working with an artist earlier this year on the movement project as well. So that should be coming through on our existing movements to see some of the work we've got been doing on them. So it's some interesting stuff. And I think really the kind of the approach that we have to designing and making stuff will start coming through more on other aspects of the watch, the movement really. I mean, rather than just the dial and obviously the hands that we're making. So it'll be more kind of take on the whole thing. But I mean, these things always take time. And
yeah, I mean, it's really interesting and exciting to reflect back on kind of the evolution of how far you've come in such a short time, in 2 years, to where you're going. I mean, when we started, you had Model 1s, fairly standard cases, but amazing dials. And then you went to Model 2, you started making hands in-house. You created the Fume dial, which we should probably talk about because that's pretty amazing as well. So you've evolved the dials and then you've changed the case profile. You've sort of evolved and refined the design. And now you're sort of progressing in a very logical and thought out and considerate fashion to encompass other aspects of the watch to make it a even better value proposition and even more compelling product than it already is. Like, I mean, that's a wonderful thing to hear.
Yeah, I'm glad you think that, Roman, because I feel like I've been kind of babbling off in different directions, but that summarized it quite well. Thank you. That's good. yeah, I like being told it's rational and thought through. It's good. When you're saying that, but the early cases being quite basic and the dials being nice, it's reminded me of the printing, which the first few months of printing was gave me. When you look at a really early Model 1, the printing is not as crisp at all as the later ones, which I feel bad about for the kind of the owners in a way, but they're probably in the long term be quite special.
Think of it as like the early F. Pigeons. They're worth more.
Because they're rubbish, yeah.
So if anything, if we've got owners of early pieces, you should buy a modern one to compare, put some by side. So buy another one and then compare the two. That's what I plan to do anyway. Would you want to maybe tell us about one of the things that I was wondering and I was hoping you would tell us about is the Fume dials that you came out with. Maybe tell us what it is and kind of how you managed to do it. There's only a very, very few companies, even the big Swiss companies, who do Fume dials at all.
Well, yeah, they're not. So there's only one enamel Fume dial out there apart from ours. And it was before ours as well, I should say. But they do it in a different way. So they have two enamels in the same dial, and they have a darker one to the outside, lighter to the inside. So what we do is a Fume dial in enamel, but it wasn't like, obviously the Moser dials are very famous. They everyone else who makes dials do it by spraying the dial while it spins round, or while the spray spins round, I think, to gradiate it. We weren't trying to make a Fume dial when we made ours. We just were experimenting with, I think we started to experiment with silver as a base rather than copper. And one of them walked up, so the middle of it rose up, and the outsides didn't.
I never knew that.
So we're like, that looks really nice, but it's completely wonky and it won't fit in the case. So we got, let's try and fix this. So that's where it came from, and it was later on that we're like, what are we going to call this? And we're like, well, it looks a bit like a Fume dial, and people know what that is, so let's not try and reinvent the wheel and call it that. But it's actually like no one else makes a dial. That is
that's very cool.
It is like that. So it's not it's not actually what you'd think of as a Fume dial. But and so the way that we've made it is that to try and replicate this faulty dial that we've made, we started working with a die sinker because before this all our dials were flat pieces of silver or copper that we cut out into disc. And then we thought, well, what we need is a piece of silver that's flat, but with a little mounted in the middle, like a mound, not quite a mountain,
like a pie pan. Yeah.
And so the bottom is flat, and the top, once it's enameled, will have to be perfectly flat. So what happens is that the outsides are at the kind of slope of the little raised part of the dial, have more enamel, and the middle has less enamel.
Mm.
So if you looked at it in a cross section, you'd see a kind of a a little hill of silver, and that would be going up. And so at the top, I think we've got, I might get this slightly wrong, but it's something like 0.25 millimeters of enamel at the top. And at the edges, it's 0.4 or 0.5, something like that. So it's incredibly small amounts that will make the difference between that particular enamel being dark and light. And so there aren't that, you can't do this with opaque enamels, obviously. And there aren't that many transparent enamels you can do it with, because most of them will either look dark all across or light all across. But there are some where that tiny amount of depth will make the difference between and kind of bring that color out. So so we discovered that when we had the Model 2s and the Model 1s weren't in production. And so we thought, this is really cool. We're going to have to make some of these. And it's a bit weird, really, because the Model 2 was meant to be this sort of field watch, kind of robust, rugged thing.
Yeah.
And we ended up putting this very kind of glitzy, sparkly dial in it, which doesn't at all tie in with it's kind of fun, isn't it? But
it looks amazing, though. One of the Fifth Risk crew, and shout out to Benoit Petit Seconde, he's got the blue Fumé dial, and that's
France, yeah.
See, it's so nice that you know all your customers, right? I mean, that's wonderful. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, if you ring up Rolex, then they're like, oh, yeah, the guy from, you know, Paris. Yeah, we know him. Like, it's never going to happen, right? Like, it's the beauty of the indies. His watch is incredible. Like, he's a good photographer as well. So when he puts a picture out, it's just mind-blowing, just stunning.
Yeah, the team have just, you can see the difference between where they've come from, you know, getting everyone very stressed about getting one watch made a week, to be able to produce something like that in a couple of days is it just kind of just shows how much work they put in and how kind of passionate they are. So it's nice. We're doing those in the Model 1 again soon, or not again. We're doing to start with.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that was meant to come out at the beginning of the year, but we realized we had to just change the case ever so slightly. So that set us back, but they look spectacular. I think we're doing them with a kind of gold, well, the ones that we've prototyped have got just gold kind of printing on them, and they look very very kind of
cool. Wow.
Spacey and sort of they're nicer.
It's amazing to me that watchmaking has been going since the 1450s or whatever, whenever the Germans and the Huguenots and kicked off, doesn't matter, you know, but they've been doing enamel and all that, and no one has figured out that if you do an area that if you just shape the plate of the dial slightly differently, with so you'd have your peripheral areas having a thicker pool of enamel and the top the center having thinner, that would give you that sort of color. I mean, it's amazing that you stumble on it by accident, and I guess on the other hand, you stumble on it by accident and actually turn it into an asset rather than going just putting it into your, you know, reject bin. But that's awesome. I mean, that's wonderful. That's a contribution that you've made to the field of horology and, you know, jewelry making, whatever it is. Like, that's a thing that you made happen.
Maybe too, because you have the flexibility to sort of play with it and look at it instead of, you know, binning it, whereas other people might have been too focused or, you know, too specific about just the enameling.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a good point. I mean, because one of the reasons we can come up with interesting stuff is that we're all on top of each other in the studio. So if something interesting comes out and it's wrong, it's not just a case of that goes in the bin, try again. It's like, that's better, let's go in this direction instead. Whereas if you're working with an enameling, you know, if you're outsourcing your dials, whatever they're made out of, and you ask this design, they're going to come back with that design. And they're not going to go, this is completely different, but how about putting this sparkly dial in your field watch? You know, it's not going to be one of the like advantages we have of working this way, because I'm sure, I mean, there'll be thousands of enamelists in the past who have made similar dials, but
yeah,
so put them to one side.
But certainly, I mean, it seems like you and your team, you definitely have that flexibility where you are to, you know, to explore, to, it seems, especially when you mentioned in the beginning about the colors, how, you know, you weren't really focused on you know, what anybody else thought, if they would necessarily sell or not. You just had an idea, and it seems like you certainly have the freedom to see it come to fruition. And even when you mention the in-house movements, to have the freedom to pursue that, and with the goal of, you know, providing value, or to meet that idea you have to present this, you know, this package.
Mm. Yeah, it's I suppose it is a bit. I think that all comes from kind of having the luxury of being fairly comfortable in terms of work coming in. So I mean, if we had a big pile of watches to sell and had to get them out, then it would probably be a very different company. But we'd be much more focused on how do we come across best to customers, and how do we like market things. And, you know, but if we're always busy with making stuff, we can kind of, you know, fiddle around with them and treat things in an approach to that's slightly different, and maybe a bit more idealistic than if we're in a different setup. So
yeah, busy hands, happy hands. That's right.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
So do you know where your majority of your owners are, or customers are located? Like, you know, do you have kind of a rough idea?
Yeah, they're it's mostly in the States.
Yeah, interesting.
Pretty definitely. Yeah. It is. I think it's probably like that for most watch companies, just because, you know, if you're kind of English speaking press, then that's I imagine most watch companies are in that category. But the States is by far the biggest country where you get a lot of watch enthusiasts. So a lot of it. And but no, Australia, definitely got a little cluster with you guys.
We
there.
Do what we can.
And the UK is like there are some, I'd say probably 60 or 70% of the US.
Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, I was going to bring this up a bit later, but I mean, we can congratulate you on, you're in a museum now, right? I mean, you're in the Museum of Modern Art. It's amazing.
In the gift shop.
Well, you know, you start from the gift shop, then you move into the collection. You know?
Yeah. One day. That was really nice. They just it was completely out of the blue. They sort of got in touch and asked if we wanted to chat about it. So that was lovely. And also, I mean, the only other kind of high end, but new, not non quartz watch in there is the Nomos range, which is obviously they have good taste. So it was nice to see us in there.
But I mean, I think what you do kind of appeals to them. I mean, Nomos there is, I'm sure, purely by design, because, you know, it's Bauhaus and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a beautiful thing. That's fine. I mean, but you guys are there, because I looked at their shop and there's like a little presentation tray, and it's all, you know, handmade in Scotland. Each, you know, there was a little thing about like each piece is handmade. Like, it clearly appealed to their aesthetic of, this is a maker from the remote Scotland's remote. It clearly had enough of a draw.
Yeah.
Which really imbues, in my mind, exactly the special spark that makes what you do in Glasgow so special, that attracted me in Melbourne and the curator at MoMA. You know, just that same kind of thing, like human hands.
It's not, it is a lovely, lovely thought, that actually. I should say that wooden tray was made by Method Studio, who are another Scottish-based maker, and they make some phenomenal. They make lots of they make boxes for the Struthers.
Oh, cool! Oh, you got to better send me a thing. I'll link them up in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a husband and wife team with in the middle of the forest in this old logging place, and they just make incredibly beautiful stuff. It goes all around the world as well, actually. They made that for us. It was an interesting one to look at.
And it's so nice that you got that to complement your watches. Because one of the things I remember when I received my watch, and once again, my watch was early days of when you started. I mean, the presentation that when I got the box was like superb. You know, it was like a handwritten note. I think it was like a little note to say thank you. And then like the leather pouch was great. Like the straps were, it was just beautifully put together. Like it was clearly put together with care is really the best way to explain it. And it was really wonderful.
I think that's just comes with having a lot of different designers in the company that are very fussy about these things. But it's good. And actually, we hired, Erland was who kind of is the sort of front facing person in the company now, and we hired him primarily. I wouldn't say, no, not entirely, but his handwriting, the quality of his handwriting was like one of the main things. Because when we advertised that job, the application process was send us a letter, and he had this beautifully handwritten letter. So we were like, this is our man.
Wow.
And well, we took him on. So yeah, the letters. Because I was writing them before, and they were so badly written that I felt like I couldn't continue doing this, and needed someone with.
But that was a lovely touch. I mean, it was a lovely touch. I have to say, I've bought a number of watches, both higher and lower. That was just one of those things. Once again, like the watch takes a while to make. That's not a problem because it was a human at the other end making it. But then getting it's a beautiful pouch, and then having this little note that Dirksy said, thank you for your support. We've made it just for you. Hope you enjoy it. Like it was just lovely. It was a lovely human touch, which the luxury, and once again, this is an audio medium, so you can't see the air quotes I'm doing, but experience doesn't really translate. Like that's lost, unless you're a chic or royalty or something, like a regular punter, you don't get that even buying a product that's 10 times the cost of yours. So I thought that was just a watch was great, and the way it was presented was even better. So yeah, it was awesome.
That's really nice. Yeah. I think that might be it. I mean, we're incredibly lucky with customers being just very, very nice people. And I think when we started out, and we didn't know if anyone was going to buy them to start with, but we didn't know who was going to be buying them. And we've never ever had a kind of a difficult customer or someone who's kind of grumpy about the weight. So it's obviously people are kind of understanding, and it's nice. I think it's one of the nice things is kind of talking to people on the other side of the kind of order process. So yeah, and I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, because I don't think I've in this conversation you certainly come across as being very humble. I think I don't think it's necessarily just luck of the customer. It's just this experience that you give customers such as Roman. It's very like unique and personal experience that. I think it's well worth it. It's a great watch. It's a great experience that sort of draws them in and makes that connection between them and Ardain.
Thanks, Sean. I think it's easy to be humble when it's not you doing any of the difficult stuff. if it was if I was like the genius watchmaker who could do all this and assemble and stuff. I mean, when we first started out, I couldn't find a watchmaker anywhere, and I so the first watches we put out were to press, and they were assembled by me based on YouTube tutorials, because I still couldn't find a watchmaker. So but luckily it was pretty bad, and some of them are still out there, actually. I have to say, I think Elizabeth Doa has one, and she's never commented on it, which was nice. But no, we found Chris turned up. He had been doing BHI courses, doing all training and servicing people's watches by night, and working in Amazon as a picker by day. And he absolutely hated his job, but that was his. So we found him through the local BHI chapter, I think a week after we launched. And I met him on Friday afternoon, and I was like, yeah, we start on Monday. And that was it. So that was me off the hook. But I do know how it can be difficult. And he commented on how terribly I'd put the watches together. He said that the hands were kind of bowed at different angles, and it was a miracle that they didn't kind of stop after they kind of passed each other. So it was very fortunate we found him. So I'm kind of watching all the people in Anodyne doing their individual things and doing really well. And so
you're the benevolent dictator in the company. You just let the subjects go along with scurry along with that little bit.
that's the one.
So what I mean, COVID has been, this year has been terribly disrupted with all the things you had planned for the pipeline. So what do you think, what can we as a devoted public can look forward to, let's say, for the remainder of 2020?
It's a good question. I was, I'd hope to be getting this Model 3 out. I think so. We'll put that out somehow. Maybe a newsletter or put it on the website. Just because it's an interesting, and we've got, five different versions. They're all different and just they're lovely things to look at. So that as not a release will hopefully come out soon. The Fume Model 1s are really, really quite nice.
Can't wait to see those.
They shouldn't be too far away. And we're doing a large Model 2, which has got quite an interesting mixture of heat bluing and looming, which I don't know. Have you guys seen that?
No.
Come across that before? No. Maybe because it's not possible. We've actually tried it yet. We've got the hands.
Small experimenting.
So if you don't see it, you know why. I don't know maybe if it won't adhere to the blue. I don't know. It hasn't been done, but we designed these hands, and these hands are actually getting made out in very, very compact. The gaps between the Model 2 hands. So they've got these two bits are parallel. And there's a tiny gap. And so Estima are making those over in Switzerland, and then we're going to get them back. We'll blue them, and then we'll send them to another firm we work with to a very precise blooming, and then we'll bring them back again. So that's we're hoping that'll be quite an interesting kind of variant on a kind of field watch.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah. And so those two things should be out this year. And then next year there are some other things, but they're probably kind of too much in flux to kind of commit to.
Oh, you've got a lot of things on the boil already.
Yeah, there's constantly a lot. But then it's But no, I'm pretty sure that lot will come out this year, so we should get those things out. And and there's also a nice thing around engraving as well, which hopefully won't be too far away. But I think that engraving is something we've been getting into because it kind of goes hand in hand with enameling.
So that's engraving on the dials, or engraving on the movements, or cases, or
on the dials.
Oh wow!
So when you're working with engraving, like, as you know, kind of with engine turning, and you put some a thin layer of transparent enamel on top of that, it really kind of brings it out.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah,
we've kind of not gone down the engine turning or the more traditional routes, just because I think there are people doing that so well already. That we thought we'd try and explore different ways of approaching it. But the same principle of using enamel and sort of silver in this case, that is kind of reflecting the lights in different ways. So it's the same principle, but just maybe a more...
Yeah, that's very cool. I'm getting a watch made at the moment in the UK, and that will have a engraved and enamel dial on top. So yeah, that'll be very cool. That's so interesting. That
are you? What? Which one's that one?
Yeah, we can talk offline.
Oh yeah,
it's an as yet unreleased project, but I'm happy to chat to you offline because there might be some common skills or something. But yeah,
that'd be cool.
So cool that these little pockets of skill and things are evolving. That's just so exciting. Yeah, that's really awesome. Now, any final question, Sean, before we kind of start to wrap up?
No, it's been quite an interesting experience. I mean, you seem like quite a humble person, and I've been following for a while, and I'm very interested to see what comes out with the next Model 1 that you had spoke about, because I'm particularly interested in sort of things that gives a space feel or aesthetic.
Yes, very much.
And you mentioned that's something in the works. Yeah, so I'm certainly watching it with keen eye. I think you guys produce something that's quite special and very contemporary and unique in feel. So yeah, I'm very excited.
Oh, thanks. So if you we did there's a customer who's had a son who's really interested in space rockets and things, and we designed a dial for them which was made up of different space rockets. It looks really, it's again in gold.
Oh, cool.
It looks cool, but I'm not sure if that's going anywhere at the moment, but I'll send you a picture of it after.
Yeah, please.
It's quite, if you like space, Sean, this is cool.
Yeah, please.
My 6-year-old will definitely love that as well, so yeah, for sure.
It's, if only 6-year-olds bought watches. I know that would be mine would very much like one with unicorns on, and I imagine the other would probably get me to do dinosaurs, so we could
totally
probably branch out at some point.
Well, look, I think we might start to wrap up. I think it's been a great conversation, and I mean, one of the reasons I particularly wanted to have a chat with you, Lewis. I mean, I've been a huge fan of Anodyne, and I've been talking the ears off people here in Melbourne about it. Yeah. Because thanks, I think really. It's so exciting to see what you guys do with so much integrity, artistic flair, and also so much investment of yourself into the product, which is like just wonderful. It's very rare to see. So that's why all our listeners, if you're not familiar with Anodyne, definitely check Anodyne out. So what's the best way to do that, Lewis?
On the internet, probably. But if you're in Glasgow, you can come and visit. I would recommend if you're ever in Glasgow, if anyone's ever in Glasgow and they're interested, just come in and kind of come and see us. Hopefully there'll be less of the kind of COVID issues, but visiting studios is great. So I would that or the website or a newsletter. Oh, we're doing a magazine as well. That's worth signing up for because I think it's going to be quite interesting.
There you go.
So
on top of the watches and the other watches and the enameling and the movements, you're branching out into publishing. Fantastic.
We hired our editor just at the beginning of lockdown. So she's editing a magazine, which is actually it's pretty good. Hopefully people like it, but it's interesting. It's not all watches; there's other stuff as well. So it's a nice mix. But if you sign up for that, it'll get posted out to you. So that'd be good.
Oh, there you go, people. Even more of a reason to sign up as well. Yeah. Alrighty. Well, look, before we jump, so one of the things we do here as well, Fifth Reese, is we ask our guests and ourselves really to sort of. Things to discover, people to follow, Instagram or anywhere really, just for ourselves to grow and kind of, expand our horizons. I might throw to Sean first if you've got somebody that you wanted to recommend, Sean.
Yeah, I do. I'm taking advantage of the more lax rules since the podcast has sort of matured. Instead of recommending a watch specific Instagram, I want to recommend a Instagram called Just Cassette. JustCassette. They take photos mainly of vintage Walkmans or CD players, cassette players, and whatnot. But I really like it because it much of the aesthetics is from the the 70s, 80s. So it's it's sort of a Tokyo or Japanese New Age kind of look. It reminds me of. If you're familiar with, the plethora of G-Shock models that are out there, it's just exciting to see this, to see, all the different types of cassettes and the sort of, futuristic designs they had at the time and whatnot, sort of the, space-inspired design. So that's my recommendation.
That sounds fun, yeah.
Wow, that's like my childhood and early teenage years in that one account. That's awesome. And for our millennial listeners, if you don't know what a cassette is, I mean, first of all, you can stop listening now. And secondly, Google it. but that's a beautiful account. It's amazing how those objects still have so much personality, even though they look really clunky and they're completely obsolescent and obsolete. Yeah. But yeah, they just have so much personality. Yeah. Yeah. That's a really cool account. What about you, Lewis? I'll put you on the spot. I don't know if you had anybody you wanted to.
Yeah. If anyone knows about watches, it's quite an obvious one, but if there are people who don't, one of my favorite brands is Moritz Grossmann.
Yes.
And I saw their Instagram and they have half as many, we don't have very many followers, but they've got half as many. So I've just maybe realized that maybe not that many people are sort of appreciate what they're doing. And they are, I mean, to me, they're just the level of kind of watchmaking craft that goes into that is phenomenal. We did heat browned hat. Heat browned, you can heat blue, but you can kind of stop it halfway and do kind of a goldy color. And we got that from them. I mean, like we kind of learned that from what they were doing. And I don't think that's not like a widely done thing. But they're just, I mean, the quality of work, the hands they make are beautiful, the movements. I mean, they're just and the person who runs it, I think, is a lady called Christine Hutter, I think. She's also got an Instagram account. They're another company with just a huge amount of passion for what they do, and they've got some really phenomenal watchmaking. So I think if you're into watches, which you probably are listening to this, and you're not following them, then I would they come up with some beautiful stuff. So I would perhaps look at them.
That's a great recommendation. I mean, they are a cracking brand. Once again, one of those like in the know. Yeah, to hugely. And you're right, they've got probably the sexiest hands in business. Mm. You know, like just it's incredible. Yeah, absolutely incredible. And the movement finishing is phenomenal as well. So yeah. No, that's brilliant. That's a great one. The one I've got for today is Mr. No Date. So Mr. Dot No Date.
N-O-D-A-T-E. Oh, I know him. Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons I picked him is he's got an Ordain model too. I love that you know your own. That's brilliant. That's so nice. And that's the thing, people. If you buy an Ordain, you can never flip it because Lewis will know. He knows where you live.
Yeah, I know.
He'll look you up.
The Mr. No Date. Yeah, he's got the cracking Ordain, but also he's got some Grand Seikos and then selection of Rolex. You can just scroll past those. It's a pretty cool account. It's a pretty cool account.
Yeah. Good recommendation there.
Great account there. Well, look, we might wrap up there because I know you've got things to do and stuff. But look, Lewis, once again, can't thank you enough for joining us for today's episode. And yeah, I think I've certainly learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners will discover how awesome what you do is.
Thanks, guys. Brilliant. No, I honestly really appreciated your kind of condensed and nicely articulated versions of my babbles. Because I think next time, if we come on again, I might just tell you, and then you could just do the show on your own. And because you did, it's been good. Thank you very much for that,
Sean. Once again, thanks for joining me as well, because that was awesome.
Yeah, certainly a pleasure, and great to be able to speak with you, and especially Lewis.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, likewise. Thank you, guys.
Brilliant. And the last thing we do is something we always say at the end of each episode. You know, we set up Fifth Wrist as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. You know, so if you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on the podcast and have a chat with us, please get in touch. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website, fifthwrist.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a review. Helps to spread the word. We read your comments. Follow me. I'm at Times Roman AU. Sean is at The Book Watch. And our guest, Lewis, is at Enordain. We'll put some links in the show notes for Enordain's website, reviews and things that we mentioned in the podcast. Thanks for joining us today. And as we always say, stay on time.